Global Research NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. We're back on the economy again today with a regular on this program, and I'm so delighted to have her back for an extended program today and tomorrow. And I'm speaking about Ellen Brown. But I alerted Ellen a little bit ago. I just wanted to say one thing before we get into the discussion. And for those who don't know Ellen, I'll explain exactly who she is. But I learned this morning that within the last 24 hours, I got an email from another guest who's been on the program a couple of times, Brian Concannon. Brian is a human rights lawyer. He's the head of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. And a blessed Haitian man passed away in the last 24 hours, a man named Father Gerard Jean Juste, or as Haitians knew him, Father Jerry. He was cut out of the same mold as President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, absolutely dedicated to helping his people, a social activist. It ended him in prison for doing his work, feeding the hungry, protesting acts of injustice of all kinds. He passionately supported nonviolence. He was against illegal arrests. All the things that go on routinely in Haiti, a country that's been under occupation because of the coup d'etat that Washington instigated against the democratically elected president who won his reelection with 90% of the vote. Imagine that. A legitimate election that the folks who didn't want him tried to rig against him, and he still won with 90% of the vote. And, I mean, he would win today if his name just appeared on the ballot without showing up with 90% of the vote. The same thing would go for Father Jerry. He was beloved. He had leukemia. It worsened in prison, and he got virtually no medical care. They finally let him out. He went to Miami, and he got some treatment, but apparently it took its toll on him. And he finally passed away. It's a very sad moment. I feel a sense of deep remorse about it. And I once tried to get him on this program, but I think he couldn't do it because the illness was too much. I guess he just wasn't doing any of this. Rest in peace. The Haitians will dearly miss him. Let's go on with the program. About a minute before the first break, Ellen Brown is the guest. Ellen is a civil litigation attorney, an author, a frequent writer on financial issues, and her absolutely remarkable book that I've written a little about and we discussed the last time she came on, and we can do it again today. It's called Web of Death. It is really an extraordinary analysis of the private banking cartel Federal Reserve with historical context and information on a system that really works. Not one that is a predator system, run for the interests of bankers against the interests of the people. And sadly, most central banks around the world are this way. We need to get rid of them. Well, Ellen shows the way, explains what's wrong, and so on and so forth. So we want to talk about the global economy, her book, et cetera, and so on. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks, Stephen.
Oh, it's terrific having you on again. And they'll break momentarily, but where should we begin? More about Web of Death?
Well, it's up to you what interests you at the moment.
You're playing our song.
I really, really want to get a stage.
Oh, let's go ahead. Let's take the first break, and then we'll come back, and we'll get into the heart of things. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to NewsHour. I'm on with Ellen Brown. We're talking about the global economic crisis. Ellen's extraordinary book, Web of Debt. Let's talk about Web of Debt, Ellen. Well, let me say one thing. Oh, I had the book for a fair amount of time, and until a month or so ago, I had done more skimming than reading it carefully. And then I decided I really wanted to go through it awfully carefully. So I began reading, and I simply couldn't stop. I wanted to read the whole thing carefully, which I did. And then I decided, I think I mentioned this to you, that I wanted to write something about it. And I honestly began saying, oh, there's so much in here. It is just crammed with so much vital information. Maybe what I'll do is just write one article and just cover some of the highlights. And once I started, I couldn't stop. I just wanted to tell the whole story. So I just went on and on and on and on. And, I mean, you just, what can I say? The book takes my breath away. If listeners want to know, what's wrong with the way we run things financially, economically, and how we can do it the right way, to get hold of Ellen's book, and you updated it, Ellen, the end of 2008, so it's very current, and it is one devil of an investment to make, so we can know what can work, what we should be doing, and all the things that we're doing wrong. Oh, I could go on and on.
Thanks, Stephen. I'm actually an English major, you know, in search of a good subject, so I spend a lot of time just trying to figure out how to make each chapter make you want to read the next one like you do in a novel, you know, lay some clue for what we're going to find out next so that you won't want to put it down. That's the trick of the trade.
Oh, you did it. Oh, you absolutely did it. Well, I'm just a retired small business guy, and, you know, what do I know about fancy-dancy economics? But people read some of the articles that I write, and some of them think I'm some great scholar or professor, and I said, no, I'm not that at all.
But, well, I do think that people who have been through school in economics, it's like medical school. You get so confused by overwhelming data that you really don't see the forest. I mean, it really is easier for us on the outside to see what's going on because it's actually quite simple. I saw that Ben Bernanke said recently that some mentor, I don't remember who, had told him that their job with monetary policy was to make it as boring as possible, which they have done. I mean, he was apologizing that he hadn't succeeded in making it boring during his term as head of the Federal Reserve. But in general, that appears to be actually the goal, is to make monetary policy or economics in general to be so obscure and so difficult that we'll leave it alone and leave it to the experts. I mean, most people feel frustrated anyway. They really don't want to know because it's too complicated. It does seem boring, and there's nothing they can do about it. And it's just depressing. I mean, why get into something that you can't even affect? But when you do realize what's actually going on here, it's actually some simple principles, and we the people are the only people who are going to change it. We're the only people that have the power to change it. Even the president, let's say the president with the best will in the world, knows what's going on and how he wants to change the system. He can't just walk in there and say, all right, we're going to get rid of all these banks, or we're not going to bail these banks out. We don't need them. We'll just set up our own banking system over here. He'd either get shot, as Lincoln did, or he would get ridiculed and criticized to death. Everything that went wrong would be blamed on him. So really the president himself just has to wait for the people to have this groundswell of outrage that forces him to play his hand, it seems to me. I mean, that's what Roosevelt said. I agree with you, now make me do it. So that's why we have to understand before anything is going to change. And what's quite frightening is what's going on with the Bank for International Settlements and the G20 and the Bilderberg Group. I mean, they're inches away from a global, private, global central banking system where we have to borrow money from somebody in Switzerland who's printing it. I mean, they're calling it SDRs, and technically it's the IMF, but there's talk about switching it over to the Bank for International Settlements, which is a quite, it doesn't have a good reputation historically. I mean, it's suspicious. It's not who you necessarily want in charge of your whole global economy. And it's all private. We didn't vote for any of that. The G20 passed something called the Financial Stability Board that we've all signed on to, and Congress didn't vote on that at all. Unlike with Bretton Woods, where they actually voted for the thing, it was just our representatives just kind of got sucked into signing that would be our president. And it includes something called, let me see what is the name of it, the 12 key international standards and codes that we all adopt, we all agree to implement. Well, it's very hard to even find those on the internet. You can find them on the FSB website, and then they're incredibly broad. I mean, they cover virtually everything. Like, one thing that stood out was the structure and function of government. So they're going to check to make sure that we all have sound and stable structures and functions of government. Well, what does that mean? What if they look at our government and they decide we're too whatever, this or that, we're not in line with the global majority? Or what if some country decides to actually fund their budget with their own government-issued money instead of borrowing from the international bankers? And the international bankers look at that and say, oh, that's not in line with the standards and practices of the central banking system, so you'll have to change. I mean, they have total control unless we do something rather quickly. So that's why I think that knowledge is the first thing we have to do. We the people have to know what's going on.
Ellen, absolutely. Everything begins with getting informed about the most important stuff that affects our lives. It's not to be well informed so you can sound like a pretty knowledgeable man or woman when you get together with friends or family. It's all about self-defense. And then the only way, and it's been stated on this program a number of times, the only way real change comes on the big stuff is from the grassroots. And way back months ago, I had a program on it with a distinguished guest who wrote a book called Challenging Authority. And she explained, she just gave four examples in U.S. history when grassroots activism made difference enough to really change the direction of the country. And the biggest one in my mind was ending slavery. That if you go back to the early 19th century, I mean, that was the impossible dream. Well, it happened. And the civil rights, the labor movement, women's suffrage wasn't one of her examples, but that's another example as well. And this stuff doesn't happen overnight. I mean, it takes years and years of dedicated work by people who just won't quit, and then other people join with them. By the way, Ellen, next Tuesday, June 2nd, I will have a program on the Bilderbergers with Daniel Estulin, who I don't know how he does it. He has a book called The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, and I have a review done on it. I'll get it out probably next Monday ahead of his coming on. And the Bilderbergers just had a meeting in Greece. And I don't know how he gets this information, but I spoke to him once on the phone, and he got a 73-page report on this meeting. So we will discuss it on this program, his book and that. But this is a very powerful group. Name a potent figure that you can think of, and they attend these meetings. But it's all secret. Stuff has to leak out. We can only guess who was it. We've got names of people who were at this past meeting, but it's the big names. It's the Fed chairman. It's there are presidents there. There's royalty there. There are all kinds of people and lots of top officials in the Obama administration attended this past meeting, and basically they're plotting to take over the world. They want a one world government. They want one currency. They want one central bank. I mean, they want firm control over our lives. And I don't have any doubt in the world, Ellen. I think Estulin will talk about this on Monday, that they plan this whole economic crisis just the way they planned past ones, because if they can create enough chaos, they can create a situation where they can come up with this plan that sounds so terrific, but it's really to let them take over at our expense. So they come up with this idea of a world central bank and a world central currency and all of this. and cleverly convince us that it's for our own good. Well, it's not for our own good. Out of chaos comes their opportunity to get what they've always wanted, but they can't just do it. They need to create a situation that lets them do it. Oh, apparently, the big debate at this past conference, Ellen, was whether to have a very protracted, deep and ugly depression that could go on for years, or possibly have a shorter one that would be deep and ugly but not as protracted, or maybe some kind of an alternative where there's still a lot of chaos, but maybe not quite as bad as the other two alternatives. And I'm going to have to let Daniel Estulin fill us all in on exactly what he knows about what went on. And also one of the things that came out of it already was there was a lot of disagreement internally on just what direction to take, including European bankers scared to death that things are so out of hand now that they have no idea just how this is going to end up and how it will affect them. And maybe some of them are going to go under, are going to be carried out by the riptide and put out of business. So I mean, this is the kind of stuff going on. Oh, my goodness, we have another break. Let's take that, Ellen, and then you pick it up when we come back and maybe tie it in with the Web of Death. The good things we could be doing.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Ellen, can I read something that I wrote in an article that I wrote some months ago on the Federal Reserve Abolition Act?
Sure.
Oh, let me just read a couple of paragraphs. Never had Webster Tarpley on this program, but I quoted him. He was talking about the Federal Reserve, and he said, he talked about, quote, "The privately owned central bank has been looting and wrecking the U.S. economy for almost 100 years. We must end the system where unelected, unaccountable cliques of bankers and financiers, loyal to names like Morgan, Rockefeller, and Mellon, set interest rates and money supply behind closed doors, leading to deindustrialization, mass impoverishment, and a world economic and financial depression of incalculable severity." And then I added, "In theory, the Fed was established to stabilize the economy, smooth out the business cycle, manage a healthy, sustainable growth rate, and maintain stable prices. Well, it really failed. Since we've had the Fed, we've had 19 recessions, including the Great Depression, and heaven knows how this one will end up before it's over." Oh, my goodness. If Bill Engdahl is right, Ellen, it will be a dark decade. That's his forecast. And he'll come back later next month, and we'll talk more about the dark decade. Oh, my goodness. But then Web of Death, how we can get out of this whole thing. Oh, I'll let you talk about that.
Well, I agree that they act in the name of stability, but whenever they do that, what they're basically doing is going against market forces, which we purport to be all about. For instance, the plunge protection team was set up to stabilize markets, supposedly. It was set up by the president's working group on financial markets in the 1980s under Reagan. And what it's done is it allows this huge secret group to go in and manipulate markets, supposedly for the greater good. But anybody betting in the ordinary way, like the small investors, we don't have inside information about what they're about to do. And so you can get creamed for the greater good. And this financial stability board that they've just set up supposedly is for global financial stability. Well, that's where they get the excuse for setting the thing up is that everything's unstable. And as you say, I suspect they did create all this instability. And so it's the excuse for going in with this big controlling body that'll control everything. But it's certainly not in our interest. They know which way they're making things go, and we don't. I lost my train of thought.
I have an article coming out. I'll get it out tomorrow, Ellen, unless there's some shocking thing that happens today, and I have to say something about it, and it's on market manipulation. And Michelle Josadovsky wrote about market manipulation, oh, 3-4 months ago, I think now. And, there's no question. They manipulate the market so many different ways. And this plunge protection team, you know, back to the Reagan era, Ellen, you talked about it in the Web of Debt, and you inspired me to write about market manipulation and the other two groups that can manipulate markets as well. And then I changed the name of the plunge protection team at the very end. I now call it the plunge protection destruction team because they can manipulate them up or down. And you can make even more money taking them down than taking them up because they go down faster than they go up.
And you can make a case that it was the Basel Accords that actually brought on the current credit crisis. That originally we had reserve requirements, which were a bank can lend only 10 times what it has in reserve, basically. In other words, it has to keep in reserve 10% of its outstanding loans and commitments. And the banks figured out how to get around that because they were calling reserves were deposits, and then the money would get deposited from one bank to another, and then it wasn't just clear. There was this whole money multiplier effect. And so the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, the private head of the private global banking, I'll say cartel, or it's a bad word, but the global banking institution, imposed rules that now they have to base how many loans they can make on the capital they have. Well, capital is real money. You can't fiddle with your deposits to call that capital. Capital is either what you get from your shareholders or it's what you make in profit. So it's the bank's own real money. And that was Basel I, and it imposed an 8% capital requirement for ordinary loans, and then there are different ways of valuing different types of loans. But through that, they brought down the Japanese banks, which were at that time the biggest creditors in the world. They were our biggest creditors and quite a threat to the U.S. banks. And so because they had to revalue their capital, suddenly they couldn't make loans. It was the same thing that just happened to us recently. And so they were crippled by it, and they've never recovered. The banks haven't recovered, and neither has the Japanese economy. So the same thing happened to us in 2007. Well, the American banks managed to get around the rule because the rule actually allowed them to get around it because they were allowed to move loans off their books, and those loans didn't count in their risk evaluation. So how much you had to have in capital went according to how risky your outstanding loans were. So the Americans had, or American banks, the Wall Street banks had gotten around the rule. And so Basel II imposed stricter controls. It was issued in 2004, but it was imposed in 2007 on U.S. banks. Well,
we need to break, Ellen. You're going to break away. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
To the News Hour on with Ellen Brown, Web of Debt, her book, and the economy. Ellen, I just mentioned the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements you're talking about, the central bank of central bankers composed of, do I remember the number right, 47 central banks, but only about 5 or 6 or so really matter. The big ones, the obvious ones that hold all the power. And the others are just along for the ride and have nothing to say about anything.
Right.
If they don't like it, they can lump it.
Yeah, it's 55 banks, actually.
55 banks.
Yeah, and there's an inner core. Well, there's the G20, but then there's an inner core of the inner core, and they're the ones that really set the tone, apparently. So back to the Basel II. It was imposed in October of 2007, our Dow hit its all-time high at past 14,000. And then in November, Basel, the OCC, the Office of Controller of the Currency, said that they were adopting Basel II limitations, and the Financial Accounting Standards Board, which sets the accounting standards, it's private, and it sets the standards, though, for U.S. banks. They imposed the mark-to-market rule, which said that the banks had to revalue all their assets according to what they would fetch today on the market, not according to the way they were valuing. So you can make a case that this is a good thing, that you want to know what a thing's worth today. But the thing is, they did it right in the middle of where the banks were, like the Japanese banks. It was like, okay, change of rules, all this stuff that you thought were good assets, now you have to value them differently. So suddenly the banks did not have the capital to make loans, and that's what caused the credit freeze. And again, we've never recovered. They did change the rule back somewhat in April. The FASB changed the rule back, but we just haven't recovered from that. And the problem was that even though the banks now are lending, I read that they're arguing that they are making loans. Everybody says they're not. But what's gone away are the secondary lenders, the shadow lenders that were taking all those loans. These would be all the foreign investors, et cetera, they would bundle the loans up in securities and sell them off to investors. Well, the investors have gone away, and they're not coming back because they were burned. That stuff that was wrapped in derivatives and so forth was not good. But they had to do all that in the first place to get around these rules, which were imposed from abroad. So the whole thing, we are the last domino to fall. In order to get global control, they would have to bring us in line, and to do that, they had to cripple our economy, you could argue. I would argue that's probably what happened.
And maybe do a heck of a number on the U.S. dollar as well.
I saw that there were it used to be that everybody had to buy oil in dollars, and now they're moving away from that. And then there's the concern that that will bring the dollar down, but I don't think it actually will. I think the dollar is not dependent on oil. It seems to me, the solution is we have to just set up another system. You can't really fight the old system. I mean, if you have a revolution, they've already got all the military equipment, so we're going to lose. You don't really want to take to the streets. I personally don't want to get tasered. And even in Congress, I mean, nobody can just stand up and say, all right, we're going to change everything and have a new system. But what you can do is just very quietly set up an alternative and start moving over to it, and then it'll just become obvious that that's so much better. I think where we should start is every state should have its own bank, state-owned bank, and then it can do what any bank does. It will escape all this toxic stuff that's on the books of the big banks. And it can make loans for its own public projects at very low interest rates, and it never has to worry about finding creditors to borrow from. Like today, you know, the one reason the state and local governments are going bankrupt is all of a sudden the cost of borrowing is much higher. These bonds that they were in the habit of rolling over to fund all their projects, suddenly they can't get at the low rates that they used to be able to get. So that's changed their whole budget structure all of a sudden.
And that's because the economy is weak and their states are weak. This state tax revenue and sales tax revenue goes down. People are unemployed.
Also because they got their AAA ratings from these rating agencies, which lost their own AAA. The agencies lost their AAA ratings. So that was no fault of these little cities and the states. But because the rating agencies are no longer AAA rated, they can't lend that rating to the things they rate. And so the municipalities have lost their AAA ratings, which means things like pension funds that used to invest in those bonds, that they're required to invest only in AAA. And so that's why the cost of borrowing has gone up. So it's all for arbitrary reasons. We still have the same facilities. We have the same workers. We have the same potential that we ever had. Here in California, we could be just as rich as we were in the 70s. I mean, I remember the 60s. In the 60s, we were rich. You could get an education for a higher education for almost nothing. I went through law school. I swear it was $500 a semester. Maybe it was UCLA Law School, and I'm pretty sure it was $500 a semester. It was like really cheap.
Helen, I went to a pretty well-known school myself in the 1950s, and my first year's tuition, a full year, was $600.
Uh-huh.
And the tuition today is around numbers about $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's way in excess of inflation, as bad as inflation has been over the last half century. But imagine to go and state schools. So many state schools were tuition free. University of California undergrad. What wasn't it tuition free back then?
Well, my first thought was that it was $50, and then I thought, no, that can't be. It must have been $500. But it was incredibly cheap. I remember I was very dubious about going to law school, and I thought, well, I'll just go one semester and I'll live at home, and if I don't like it. But I just remember it was very cheap. And I went to Berkeley, and it was very cheap. And now it's a state school, but it's very expensive. You still have to – I'm not sure what it is, but it's very expensive.
Oh, along with everything
else. But we're hanging ourselves. But in Europe, you can get they expect to get their higher education for almost nothing. Or maybe it is nothing. I'm not sure. I mean, there are places that cover higher education. Why shouldn't we cover higher education? It's just because we think we don't have the money. But we do have the money. What is money? It's merely receipts for goods and services. It's merely a medium of exchange. And we've got the teachers, so we must have the money. I mean, we've got the facilities. We've got the things we need. We just need to put together this little credit system that will work. And what's gone wrong is our credit system has been choked by this parasite that is drawing profits off the top all the time and that is trying to get global control. I mean, it's not just that bankers make money. It's that there is something outside that's actually trying to get control of everything.
Oh, indeed. Maybe we can wait until tomorrow, because this is a two-part program, to explain how fairly easy it is to have a system where lots and lots of money can be created to do very productive things, create prosperity, do it inflation-free. Now, there's an incentive to tune in tomorrow to hear how we can take an abysmally bad system and replace it with an almost miraculously good working good system. Another point, I absolutely agree with you. I think the only way we could ever bring about the right kind of change is never do it from the top down. It would be like trying to build a house starting at the top and going down to the foundation. So the way to do it is at the state and local level. And, of course, you wrote about how it works in North Dakota. Maybe we could talk about that next. But I would ask one thing. I guess what you could do at the state level, you could do at the city level. If the mayor of Chicago and the Chicago city council decided they wanted a system like North Dakota, I guess they could go ahead and enact it and set up a City of Chicago bank to create money from deposits put into it. But explain how it works in North Dakota.
In North Dakota, all the state's revenues by law go into this one bank, the Bank of North Dakota, and it owned by the state. And it was put in place in 1919 by a populist movement. The farmers were losing their farms. These were Swedish farmers. Many of them didn't even speak English. There's one documentary and one Hollywood movie on it. And, of course, they were very independent, and they didn't want to have anything to do with any kind of movement until they just were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers and the railroad men and the granaries. And the granaries weren't taking their grain, even though it was good grain, because they actually wanted to put these farms into foreclosure. It was the goal, was to take these things over. And so when they realized that, they did band together. They passed legislation that all the state's revenues would go into a state bank. And then it has a mission statement. So the mission was to generally help the community and help the farmers, and education is one of their goals. And now they've added alternative energy. So they have these certain projects that they fund particularly. But the way they keep from alienating the banks or being in, the private banks or being in competition with them is that they actually partner with them. They act like a central bank. In fact, most loans are initiated at by the private bank, and then the Bank of North Dakota joins in and adds funds and adds guarantees and so forth. So they have the lowest unemployment rate in the country right now. They're one of only three states that are actually solvent. In fact, they have a $1.2 billion surplus, which is the most that they've ever had. They have a very vibrant educational program. They have lots of money for student loans. So what they've done is they've managed to keep their credit system in the state, working for the state. There's nobody drawing profits off the top. The profits go back to the state because the state's the owner. So any state could set something up like that. They may have to change some legislation, but there's no federal legislation that says they can't do it. Some states say, for instance, that in Michigan, there's legislation that says the state can only own up to 50% of a bank. So you'd have to get private investors for the other half. But you could change that legislation, or you could even do it that way. You could still, Chinese banks are 80% publicly owned and then 20% privately owned, and they still are all about development and public purposes.
Oh, indeed. In China, the government of China has the power to direct the People's Bank of China to spend their money to grow the country. And the reason in China is because they have this gargantuan population, and it's growing by many millions each year. And there's a lot of rumbling beneath the surface there. When people can't find jobs and they have economic problems, people get very upset when they're not certain where the next meal is coming from. So China is hell bent on growing their economy any way they can, because they have to create jobs. They may be lousy jobs, but they have to create jobs for millions of people coming on the job market all the time. It's an enormous problem, but by hook or by crook, they make it work, at least to some extent. So they're adding jobs while we're losing jobs. By the way, Ellen, your newest article, you have a heck of a state problem in California, and you wrote an article with Schwarzenegger moaning and groaning. I mean, the nincompoop, all he has to do is read your article to know how to fix his problems. So your article is called, "But Governor, You Can Create Money, Just Form Your Own Bank." And then you might have had a subtitle, something like, you can solve this problem if you just read this article below and you can solve your problem. Case closed.
Yeah, he said that what prompted that article, he said in his recently, a few days ago, he said that he wished we could create money, but we couldn't. We're stuck with, we have to deal with the money we have. And then for this reason, because the voters would not approve higher taxes or further debt, that they were going to have to start laying off teachers and a lot of public employees. Well, that's scandalous. That's horrible. I mean, we used to be the richest. We used to be one of the richest countries, fourth or fifth or something in the world for wealth, and we still got everything we ever had. But so why are we laying off our teachers and our nurses? Because we don't have the credit. We don't have the credit mechanism. Our credit mechanism has frozen. So anyway, the point was that banks create our money. All of our money is created by banks. Banks create money every day. So if California were to put its revenues into a state bank in the same way that North Dakota does, it too could create money and could create the credit it needs to for all these projects. And everybody thinks that would be inflationary, but first of all, that's where all our money comes from. It all comes from credit created on the books of banks. We might as well get on the bandwagon here and take advantage of this system that the bankers have set up for it. You could make it much more efficient if the profits are going back into the state that issues the credit, or the community-owned bank. If the bank's owned by the community, the profits go back to the community. So that's one advantage. Another advantage is you control where the credit goes, and you can set very low rates and very reasonable, dependable sort of conditions so that the whatever state or local government knows that they can rely on this same interest rate for the whole 5 years or 10 years of their project. There are just many advantages to having your own credit facility.
And instead of doing something responsible like that, Ellen, at the federal level, and of course the states except for North Dakota go along, we turned over our banking system to a predator, a privately owned central bank. The central bank prints money. It's really a predator bank, and that really goes to the heart of the problems that we've had all through the years. The bank you talk about a parasite, and I guess its food source is us. That this great wealth transfer that they go through, and instead of growing the economy productively as it could, if we had government-owned banks and government-run banks, private bankers, powerful people in league with government, I call it a conspiracy. This thing was planned, and government officials went along with it way back before 1913, and they went along with this ugly system, and it simply is a way of year after year after year transferring wealth from the public to these private powerful bankers that over the years get bigger and bigger and more powerful and more powerful. And what they're doing now, I mean, this may be the grand finale of what they have in mind, to create this one world government and just continue sucking this wealth and power to themselves. This is the kind of system we have to figure out a way to get out from under, or it's going to kill us. Oh, my goodness, we're down to the last segment, Ellen, but in this case, we have another whole hour to go tomorrow.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour, on with Ellen Brown, and a reminder again that Ellen will be back tomorrow. And we'll talk more about what systems can work, and it's amazing. It honestly is not rocket science. Ellen, the article that I wrote about simple and easy solutions to the global economic crisis, I have yet to get a nasty email from anybody. But I just got one from one fellow who said he just read my article with interest, and he says, of course it would work. And then he says, and there are other simple solutions. For example, if there were a big earthquake and both New York and Washington dropped into the ocean, we could turn the country around in a few years. No, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. I've got some lambasting on, well, it's actually, I did one on Weimar Germany, and I got a couple of critical things, but one was, I won't mention his name, but he's a big libertarian writer who I actually like, and I quoted him in my book. I feel bad that he's on my case, but anyway, he said all these scathing things, and then at the very bottom he said, so the bottom line is she is not a conservative. I never said I was a conservative.
I guess
I had them all fooled. I thought I was in fact it was labeled something like wolf in sheep's clothing or something, because I was pretending to be a libertarian. Well, okay, fine. I'm not political at all. I mean, I guess I suppose I am now, but I was a housewife in the Foreign Service I was a writer and a lawyer, but I was busy writing. So I was developing my writing skills, but I was developing them on the issue of health. So I voted Democrat just because my husband voted Democrat, and it seemed like a reasonable thing to do. I mean, I watched Fox News for 5 minutes and just so I knew what was going on, and that was it. Because that's all we got, was Fox News and the Foreign Service.
Oh, my goodness.
Then,
only Fox News?
Well, I mean, we didn't have this whole range of cable like you have here.
Oh, indeed. And by the way, you've written 12 books, right?
11, yeah.
11 books?
So, I mean, it was a good period because I was busily developing my skills, and then I got involved in this lawsuit it was a Tijuana cancer healer, and he was the person that turned me into a what you would call a conservative. I mean, he totally suspected everything. He turned me into a conspiratorialist for sure. I mean, I started seeing conspiracies under every leaf. And that's what woke me up to what all was going on. And then I got divorced and came back to the States. And I, you know, it was sort of like sticking your head up and looking around and being shocked at what you see. And that's what motivated me to write this book. Well, actually, it was Ed Griffin's book. Not the famous one, Creature from Jekyll Island, but World Without Cancer was linked to the pharmaceutical cartel to the banking cartel. And it was the pharmaceutical cartel that up till then I was taking my aim at. And then I realized that you couldn't solve the problem until you fixed the money problem, that's where they actually got their power. And this was just so exceedingly interesting that I totally got steeped in it. But I can't really say that I'm any particular political party. I mean, I definitely would go along with being a populist and a greenbacker. So the parties I ascribe to, I think, are long gone.
Well, we actually had politicians in this country way back who agreed with you, Ellen, because our governments printed their own money under Lincoln, the early colonists. And, I mean, we had one heck of a lot of prosperity. I mean, it really, really worked, except for the bankers that just didn't make the kind of money that they wanted to make. Well, this will be continued tomorrow. They will break away momentarily, Ellen. So let me thank you for coming on today, and part two tomorrow. Oh, it will only get better, so please come back and join us.
It's always great talking to you. Thanks.
Okay, Ellen, thanks so much. And again, we'll continue this tomorrow. Join us then.